This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network with another submission from one of our volunteers. Ross McDermott is a documentary photographer based in Charlottesville. Last year, he lived in Japan, teaching English in a high school. The following story tells one of his experience and his travels there. Ross is looking for editing feedback. Feel free to email him with your thoughts. You can catch his email on the site at sevillepodcast.com.
This is the story of Gunkanjima, the story of an island, Battleship Island. It's mid-February and I've been living in Japan for 7 months. I teach English at a high school in a town of 300,000 people. I've come to Japan because I am a photographer, and I want to make pictures of a foreign and strange culture. Teaching English was my way in. It pays good money, I have lots of free time, but unfortunately my job is perhaps the most boring job I've ever had. I teach 12 classes a week, which breaks down to 2 or 3 classes a day. Teaching 12 classes a week could be challenging, but I teach the same 12 classes a week. By the time I reach my last class on Friday afternoon, I've memorized my lesson down to every intonation in my voice. I feel like Bob Barker from The Price is Right, repeating the same exaggerated sentences with the excitement as if it was his first day on the job. Throughout my week at school, I find myself searching the internet for hours on end. I check and send emails, write on my blog, read American newspapers online, and search for interesting places to visit in Japan. It's on a fine afternoon in February that I stumble upon an article in an Expatriates magazine about an abandoned island off the coast of Nagasaki. The journalist has never been to this island. He is reporting based off a number of stories and articles that he has found on the internet. The island's name is Hashima, but the locals call it Gunkanjima, meaning Battleship Island. They call it this because of the densely packed concrete apartment buildings and the high sea walls that stretch the length of the island and give it the appearance of a warship blazing through the open ocean. This tiny island of rock and cement holds the record for the highest population density ever recorded in the world. One might ask what a tiny island off the coast of southern Japan has to do with once the world's highest population density. It's a very good question, and it can be answered with two words: coal mining. It was the evolution of a small mining fortune that built a city upon a desolate island. It was the promise of good jobs that saw the miners make their lives with the thousands of others in a space the size of 3 football fields. It was a little black rock that formed the history of Gunkanjima into the legend that it's known for today. What occurs over the next few months is a kind of relationship that I form with this mysterious Gunkanjima. From the minute I read the story, I know it is a place I have to visit and make photographs. I decide that I will plan a trip to Gunkanjima for the spring, when I have 10 days of glorious vacation. In the months of February and March, I read all I can about this island. I scour over the internet looking for photos or historical writings. Surprisingly, there is very little written about the island, but I'm aware that my poor Japanese skills limit me from finding in-depth articles. At school, I ask around to all my fellow teachers if they have ever heard of such a place. "No," they say, "never have we heard of such a place." I tell them I'm thinking of going there, and they think I'm crazy. From what I gathered over the next few months, I wrote a brief history of Gunkanjima. The island's tiresome life traces back over 100 years to a Japanese company by the name of Mitsubishi. In 1895, Mitsubishi expanded their coal mining operation onto Gunkanjima, sinking 2 shafts by the turn of the century. As the coal mining business surged, the island grew in the number of its workers, and it wasn't long before a community developed. In 1917, there were over 3,000 people living on the island, and construction started on the first concrete apartment building. At the time, this was a monumental feat. To put it into perspective, America had built their first large-scale concrete building only 14 years earlier. Soon after, construction followed for a 9-story apartment complex that was the tallest building in all of Japan. Before World War II, Gunkanjima had a total of 30 apartment buildings when all across Japan there was little building due to the wartime efforts. The high demand for coal required that Gunkanjima continue to mine and subsequently grow. As the war took young Japanese men off to fight, Mitsubishi started to use forced labor from nearby China and Korea. By 1945, Gunkanjima had practically become a slave labor camp. Close to 1,500 people had died from mining injuries or exhaustion. I found an excerpt from a report that a Korean laborer by the name of Su Jung-woo wrote about his days on Hashima. I was one of two boys forced onto a truck in my village and taken to the government office, where several thousand other Koreans ranging in age from about 14 to 20 had been gathered. About 300 members of the group, including myself, were then taken by train to Nagasaki, where we arrived the following morning. All of us were being sent to Hashima. I thought that no matter where I was sent in Japan, I would be able to escape and find shelter with my distant relatives. But as soon as I saw Hashima, I lost all hope. The island was surrounded by high concrete walls, and there was ocean, nothing but ocean all around. It was crowded with concrete buildings as high as 9 stories. We Koreans were lodged in buildings on the edge of the island. 7 or 8 of us were put together in a tiny room, giving each person no more than a few feet of space. The buildings were made of reinforced concrete and had mortar on the outside, but the interior was filthy and falling apart. We were given uniforms like rice bags to wear and forced to begin work the morning after arrival. We were constantly watched and ordered around by Japanese guards, some of whom were wearing swords. It was excruciating, exhausting labor. Gas collected in the mining tunnels, and the rock ceilings and walls threatened to collapse at any minute. I was convinced that I would never leave the island alive. 4 or 5 workers, in fact, died every month in accidents. Modern concepts of safety were non-existent. The corpses were cremated on Nakanoshima, the little island behind Hashima. In 1959, Gunkanjima had reached the population of 5,259. That equated to 1,391 people per hectare. It is the highest population density recorded in the world. By the time the growth reached its peak, Gunkanjima had become a tiny city. There were shops, clubs, restaurants, spas, theaters, schools, and playing grounds. Everything that was needed to live a normal life could be found on the tiny island. Its only contact with the outside world was the food that was imported and the coal that was exported. The growth would not last forever, though. In the 1960s, petroleum replaced coal as the major energy provider. Coal mining was on its way out, and coal mines were closing all around Japan. Finally, in 1974, Mitsubishi officially ordered the closure of Hashima's mines. As quickly as it had been ordered, the island was evacuated. Within 4 months, the last person stepped off the island. Gunkanjima was now a concrete ghost town with a shameful history hiding under its rocks. For the past 32 years, very few people have set foot on the island. In fact, most Japanese people don't even know about Hashima. Like many sour things in Japan's history, it has been conveniently hidden from its society. I wonder what is left of Gunkanjima. I envision that visiting Gunkanjima will be like walking through Roman ruins in Ephesus or Greece. A life, a society, a history so foreign to me will speak through the walls and objects left behind. The haunting surroundings will exist only as nature has left them. But how can a ghost town exist? But how long can a ghost town exist before it no longer resembles a place of inhabitants? I know that I'm racing time, and the sooner I can explore Gunkanjima, the better. It is now April. Last week, as I was planning my holiday to Kyushu and my excursion to Gunkanjima, I thought I would write to fellow English teachers in Nagasaki Prefecture to see if anyone else had an interest in sharing this adventure with me. I was literally without a clue as to how to get to Gunkanjima, but I was prepared to pay off some fishermen or hitch a ride from anyone with a boat. To put it lightly, I was underprepared. However, my desperate situation soon turned. changed. Not only did I receive a response to my email, but I met someone by the name of Mario Gallucci, who was equally obsessed by the island. Mario lives in Nagasaki Prefecture, only an hour north of the estimated location of Gunganjima. He told me via email that 2 weeks prior, he'd actually stood at the peninsula where he could look out across the ocean to Gunganjima. I couldn't believe that someone had actually seen this island with their own eyes. With a name like Mario Gallucci, I knew he would be an instant travel companion. We exchanged stories, made some quick plans, and set a date to tackle the adventure. So now the plan is set. This Saturday or Sunday, God willing, we will make our best attempts at getting to the island. Mario and I, and possibly a third person, we'll try our luck at paying fishermen to take us out there. If that doesn't work, Mario has an inflatable boat, which by the sounds of it, will be very dangerous, but might prove our last resort to reaching the island. I'm picturing a night launch, 3 foreigners in an inflatable boat, paddling under the moonlight. It's priceless. I'm traveling to Hakata, otherwise known as Fukuoka City, to meet Mario. A second guy named Peter will also be meeting me there. He responded to my email as well, and is a friend of Mario's. He's wanted to join us in our adventure. Later I find out Peter is the kind of guy who travels to North Korea just to see what the border looks like. Besides his obvious courage, or maybe lack of good judgment, Peter speaks fluent Japanese, and I know this will come in handy. That night we drive back to Mario's island about a half hour south. We stay up to 1 a.m. talking about plans for the next day. Our conversation is filled with excitement. We share information that we had read over the past few weeks, tidbits of stories that we had heard from people, or articles of interest that will help us reach the island. Mario and Peter know considerably more than me because people in Nagasaki Prefecture had actually heard of Gunganjima. All of Mario's teachers thought he was just as crazy for trying to go there. We have to get up early the next morning, so we stop talking. The three of us, anxious for tomorrow, lie in a row of futons and blankets. Gunganjima had brought us together. We get a late start the next morning because we went to bed so late. Mario packs up half his house for the trip, while Peter and I inflate the raft to check for holes. We get on the road at 10:30 and head south for Nagasaki. Gunganjima lies about 15 kilometers south, and only 1 kilometer from the mainland. Our plan is this. We'll go to the port areas around Gunganjima and start by asking fishermen about how to get out there. Then if we have no leads, we will camp out on Takashima, the neighboring island, and attempt to paddle out in the early morning. Our biggest concern is our camera gear, and what will happen if the water is calm when we paddle out, but is choppy when we try to get back. We are dealing with the open ocean, and we don't want to mess around with a $40 inflatable raft bought from a Japanese convenience store. We reach the coastline near Gunganjima around 2 p.m. that day. Our first stop is a lookout near the cliff wall. Between two arching rocks, we can see Gunganjima resting in the horizon. The sight of it for the first time is rather unreal. It actually looks like a battleship, rising out of the blue ocean with the strength and dignity of a place that has endured so much. It is strange to see the distant horizon of buildings and imagine that a city existed within that small area. Nearly a century of labor took place on those rocks, and now it stands as a reminder of all that had been. At the place where we were looking out, there are a few divers collecting sea urchins near the rocks. I have the idea to go down and get a picture, so I wander down and start talking to the diver. When I say talking, though, it's really a series of hand gestures, followed with the 5 or 10 Japanese words that I know. The diver turns out to be really great. He breaks open a sea urchin for me, and I taste it. Besides the texture, it isn't bad. Then he breaks open another clam-looking thing and takes out a large, slimy mass. It looks like a slug on steroids. He puts that in my hand and tells me to take a bite out of it. "Dozo, dozo! Go ahead," he tells me. I'm actually considering it until I notice the thing is moving. The edges are slowly pulsing backwards and forwards like the dying heart of a small animal. It is disgusting. I politely tell him, "No thanks, friend. I motioned like I would throw up if I put that mass in my mouth. By this time, Peter and Mario see that I have started talking with this guy, so they come down too. The diver is so nice, and I'm thinking we should ask him about Gungunjima. So Peter, our trustworthy translator. So I get Peter, our trustworthy translator, to ask him if he will take us out the next morning. I am rather abrupt in my approach, but Peter smooths it out into the polite, suggestive way of asking questions in the Japanese manner. I think our question shocks the diver. He tells us he is busy the next day. I tell Peter to tell him we would pay him, and he can take us in the morning when it's dark, and pick us up in the evening after dark. Then the driver gives us the typical, "Oh, it's a very difficult thing to do such a thing," answer, which is the polite way in Japanese of saying no. Little did we know at the time, but the diver would have been putting himself in a dangerous situation by taking us out there. Both his boat and his job would have been at risk. Our interaction isn't in vain, though, because he tells us to check out the boat in the next harbor and says it will take us out there. We are on to our next clue. We thank him and walk back to the car. We drive over to the next cove and see signs for the boat. It's written in Japanese. Peter translates. I realize I would have been so lost here if it wasn't for Peter and Mario. I'm thankful for their companionship. We call the number on the sign and a woman answers. She tells us we can go out to Gungunjima and to look for a silver truck. Then she hangs up. We look for the silver truck, but never find it. So we walk around the port looking for someone who knows what we want. It is very awkward wandering around as everyone discreetly stares at us, knowing very well what we are looking for. When our eyes meet the fishermen, they look away and offer no help. Finally, Peter walks up to a group of older men standing near the boats and interrupts their conversation. When they hear him say, "Gungunjima," everyone becomes silent. I feel like we have just walked into a Western saloon and asked for a glass of milk. The eyes from the group look us up and down. One of the men takes the initiative. He kind of nods at Peter like he knows what we are talking about. He's an older man with a big round face and a baseball cap with the image of an American naval ship on the front. Peter tells him, "We want to go out to Gungunjima for the whole day, from sunrise to sunset." The other fishermen slowly walk away, knowing where the conversation is leading. The man with the cap tells us he takes people out there, but only from 5:30 to 8 a.m. That means we would have 2 hours on the island. The cost is 4,000 yen per person, about $40. I don't like the sound of his offer. I tell Peter to press him more and offer him more money. The old man gets a little more serious and starts talking up a storm. He tells us it isn't about money. He says the Coast Guard has been patrolling the island very frequently during the past year, and if he is caught bringing people out there, he would be charged a massive fine and potentially find himself bankrupt. Supposedly, a group of Japanese youth had made some loud ruckus on the island 1 year ago, and since then the Coast Guard had cracked down on trespassers. They usually start to patrol around 8 a.m., and that is why we need to get off by that time. It is also incredibly dangerous, the man would tell us. There are open mine shafts and weak concrete floors. If we are caught out there, we would have to take it up with Nagasaki Prefecture, and that would mean serious consequences. The old man continues saying, "You guys should come back next year, when things have cooled down." This is not an option, though. There is no way I'm turning around when I've already come so far. We start to see that this guy was serious and he knew what he was talking about, but I'm still torn between decisions. There must be a better way to get out there. Do we trust this guy? Is he charging us too much? Are there other boats that will take us? While I'm clearly indecisive, Mario and Peter have seemed to make up their minds. The situation is awkward enough, and they seem happy to be with the only ones spending 2 hours out there. I decide to take one more chance and test if this old guy is telling the truth. I tell Peter to mention the photographer Saiga Yuji, a photographer who had documented Gungunjima 20 years ago before and after it had closed. The old man's face lights up when he hears me mention the name. He says, "Oh yes, I know him. I was the one who took him out there back in 1984. The old man tells us all about Sagi and his work. Through Peter, I asked the old man what it was like back when people still lived on the island. Did it feel like a prison, I ask? The old man is very quick to answer the question and assures me that it was nothing close to a prison when it closed in 1974. He says the people were doing quite well then, and the living standards were moderately high. He says it was only back in the 30s and 40s when the Koreans and Chinese were working on the island that it was anything close to a prison. I kind of sense this old guy is proud of Gunkanjima, at least proud of his Japanese, and that it sits within a 30-minute boat ride from his house." After hearing this, I realized this man must be the best person to go out to Gunkanjima with. He obviously respected the work of Saiga Yuji and considered the island more than just a pile of concrete. He had been doing this for years and knew the ropes. If he isn't willing to take more money, then I know he is being honest about the threat of a Coast Guard patrol. His biggest interest is saving his job, and I respect that. We tell him we have to go. He gives us his business card. It has a picture of Gunkanjima on it. I think that is a little strange. If this guy is so secretive in his operation, why is he advertising it on his card? The next morning it will all make sense, but for the moment, we are stumped. That night we drive up to a lighthouse and set up our tent. We watch the sunset as it fades closer to the faint horizon. Below in the bay sits the Coast Guard ship, watching over the dark waters. Behind a peninsula, we can see Gunkanjima resting in the evening fog. In the hazy distance, it once again closely resembles a battleship. We have to get to bed early. At 4 a.m. we are waking up, and the three of us would board a boat for the island we've all had dreams about for the past 3 months. We wake promptly at 4 a.m. and dress in the dark. We eat a small breakfast of bananas and calorie mate, a disgusting power food resembling a crumbled brick. Peter loves calorie mate. Packing our things that morning, we feel like operatives on a secret mission. We are packing cameras, flashlights, gloves, waterproof bags, knives, first aid kits, water, and extra food. Mario jokes and suggests we throw in a pair of grappling hooks. We have no idea what to expect, so we have to be prepared. We leave the house promptly at 4:30. When we arrive at the small fishing port, there are a few cars already there. We are 30 minutes early because we want to show the captain that we are serious and not just a pack of boys wanting to goof off on the island ghost town. As the sky slowly brightens and the horizon over the ocean appears, more cars begin to arrive. They are all filled with Japanese sleepy fishermen. They are wearing an assortment of extreme-looking fishing suits with matching neon-colored life jackets and boots. They are quite the sight, especially at 5 in the morning. At first, we think these fishermen are the regular fishing guys from the village, and that they were getting on their boats for the morning catch. But then, they started to get on the boat that we are taking to the Gunkanjima. When the boat captain with his battleship hat arrives, he starts talking with the fishermen. Then it all came together. He is talking to these guys, taking these guys out to Gunkanjima for some fishing. That's why he has the image of Gunkanjima on his business card. And that's why he can risk taking us out to the island. The fishermen are the cover-up. If the Coast Guard ever comes out, he can say he was just taking us out for some fishing. The more I understand this, the more that makes me dislike the situation. I know that these fishermen will be staying the whole day out there, so why couldn't we? If I were to buy an extreme-looking fishing suit with a fishing pole, would I be granted the full-day pass? Before we are about to leave, two Japanese women and a guy on a motorcycle arrive. I can tell they are here for the same reason as us. They want to see Gunkanjima. I don't want there to be other people exploring our island. It takes away from the whole novelty of the trip. I want to be the only one, apart from Peter and Mario, of course, to explore the island in silence. This is supposed to be our island. But as fate should have it, that will not be the case. Later we find out that our captain friend takes people out there every day. He mainly takes fishermen, but sometimes he has people wanting to see the island. We are the second group of foreigners to have gone out with him, he tells us. Peter, Mario, and I are definitely the first Americans to set foot on Gunkanjima. I suppose the novelty is still there. Right before 5:30, we all find ourselves onto the boat. The two parties are clearly divided. The fishermen sit in the back, wanting nothing to do with the so-called tourists. They are wondering why people would pay money to go see an island of rubble when there is plenty of good fishing to be had. As much as I don't want to admit it, I suppose we are tourists. The six of us sit in the front hall, crowding beneath the boat's wooden sides to shelter ourselves from the choppy waves. The ocean that day is wild, and later we learn that the captain almost chose not to go out that morning. He says every day there is a 50% chance that he can deliver people to Gunkanjima. It isn't getting the boat out there that is the problem. It is getting the boat close enough to the island to drop people off. We soon discover how dangerous this task is. As we approach the island, we swing around to the eastern side. The great sea wall of Gunkanjima are suddenly upon us. At such a great height, and with the sea bobbing us like a toy in a bathtub, the presence of Gunkanjima is overpowering. As our captain steers us through the rough waters to the edge of the sea wall, a few fishermen are collecting their things from the boat and gathering at the front. They obviously know what they are doing, but the rest of us tourists are clueless. As the minutes pass, the captain begins to drive the boat towards the rocks with the timing of a wave. The captain creeps up to the wall, and the fishermen jump off in the small amount of time that the wave allows. When a wave approaches from behind, the captain throws the mortar into reverse to give the boat distance from the jagged rocks. Then he waits and charges forward again, letting off more fishermen with their extreme fishing bags and coolers. The moment is filled with excitement. I can see that the fishermen get a huge rush out of it. They're like soldiers storming the beaches of Normandy, with a second to make their leap from the boat before the imminent danger sweeps them from the platform of safety. Their execution is timed to the second. They are amazing. After the first group of fishermen is delivered to the east side of the island, we make other stops and repeat the same harrowing delivery. In 10 minutes' time, the seven of us tourists are the only two people left with the captain. He then takes us to the west side of the island and closes in on a large concrete platform sticking out from the sea wall. We are all able to jump off at the same time because the island shelters the surge of waves from the east. As quickly as the captain drops us off, he speeds away just as fast. His only words from the loudspeaker as we are climbing up the ladder are, "Hurry up!" I scrambled up the iron ladder, throw myself over the other side, and out of mere excitement lose my footing and fall on my face onto a pile of bricks. We have finally arrived at Gunkanjima. I pick myself up from the bricks and look up to the most impressive sight. Across from a large field, I see the old school building, towering 10 stories above our head. Gunkanjima feels much larger now that we are actually standing on the island. The sound of the crashing waves subsides behind the sea walls. There is a strange silence. It is as if we have entered a new world, and all that existed over those walls is the world from which we came. The buildings have presence, and the air is still. In the same moment that I'm experiencing all this, I feel a rush of panic come over me. We only have 2 hours. I have to see the whole island, but how? I want to explore every nook and cranny and walk every floor of the apartments. I don't want it to be this way. Gunkanjima is the kind of place to be discovered slowly. It demands a certain level of respect, considering its grave history. I want to revere the place, not rush through it like a crazed tourist. But what has to be done, has to be done. I tell the others farewell, to be safe, and that we'll meet up in 2 hours. Off to the races I go. I start in what I think is the hospital and move through the apartments to the mining quarters. I can hardly contain my excitement. I'm practically running from room to room, hoping to discover something wonderful around the next corner. As the sun grows higher in the sky, it becomes warm. I take off my jacket and am soon wandering around in a t-shirt. One of my first impressions is that The buildings have certainly decayed since 1984, when Saigi Yuji photographed the island. Throughout the 2 hours, I search in vain for the theater, only to later realize that the entire building has collapsed from the continual attack of typhoons. In fact, I can no longer locate many of the locations of Saigi's work. It is as if the history of the incredible island is erasing with time. The wind and the ocean are washing away year after year of concrete and artifacts. It is rather disheartening. What will come of this island in 10 years? In 20 years? Managing my way through the island proves to be difficult at times. Most of the streets are lined with rubble or overgrown weeds. Not only do I find some areas impassable, but there are places that I don't want to walk in fear of falling to my death. I pass holes in the walkways and peer into them. Sometimes I can't see the bottom. The darkness stretches far below, maybe 40 or 50 feet deep. In other areas, I walk over concrete slabs and hear my steps echo beneath me. I feel like I'm walking through a minefield, or every step could lead to my most unfortunate death. The apartments are perhaps the most interesting part of my exploration. After wandering up the crumbling stairways of the high-rises, I search the long hallways, peering into each room to discover an object standing in the dust. Each object is like a story. A person has owned that item, has worked with it, lived with it, and cherished it. With each object I find, I try to imagine what the owner's life would have been like, living in this tiny room. How old were they, and what was their role in this society? Throughout the 2 hours, I come upon many things. I find toys, a dental mold, an x-ray machine, a piano, an abacus, comics, a fake tree, a television. The objects have all aged in beautiful ways. I suddenly begin to understand the fascination that people have with digging up objects from the past or diving to explore shipwrecks. It is a remarkable experience to view an object that has remained still in time, that tells a story of the past. Within the 2 hours, I practically run through every building, making photos of objects or compositions that particularly strike me. I feel like I have just barely touched the surface of the island. It is everything that I have waited for the past few months, but somehow it doesn't quite satisfy. I know there is more in each room than below the concrete. I want to see the mines and the tunnels in each building with the sun hitting it on a different side. I want to listen in peace as the waves crash against the sea walls. And as strange as it might sound, I'm expecting to meet someone on the island. I'm expecting to go into a room and see a man or a woman sitting at a chair, going about their daily business. I suppose I feel this way because the presence of life seems to fill the island with such a strong force.